This lecture is concerned with the union, intersection and difference of sets represented by binary search trees. So far, we've only looked at operations that add or remove a single element from a set. Now we're looking at bulk operations that combine two sets. Of course, you can simulate these bulk operations by the single element operations. For example, if you look at union, of course you can create the union of two sets by taking one element after the other from one set and adding it to the other set. Let us analyze then how costly this union is if you do it one by one. We assume that C of X is the cost of adding one element to a set of size X. Then if you're adding M elements to a set of size of N elements, then the overall cost is this sum, where the first term in the sum is the cost of adding a single element to the initial set of N elements, and the final cost in this sum is the cost where you add the last element to the union, to the almost union of the two sets. Now, question is, does this somehow depend on whether we add the smaller set to the larger one or the other way around? Yes, it does. The final term in the sum is always the same, no matter whether the initial term n is the smaller or the larger term. But the number of summations, the number of summands that you have here, that depends on whether you choose as the starting point n or m, the larger or the smaller element. And therefore, in order to keep this sum small, to make it have as few summands as possible, you should start with the larger number, the n. And so that's the gist of it. You should add the smaller set to the bigger set, because then you are performing fewer operations and the cost of all these operations are the same as if you would have done it the other way around, except that you have fewer of them. So if you assume that the cost is logarithmic for adding a single element, then the cost of this whole sum up there, this one, can be upper bounded by the product of m, the number of summands in here, and times the largest one element in the product, and that is the logarithm of the final set n plus m. And that can again be simplified to the O of m times log n. You can do a similar analysis for intersection and difference. Okay, m times log n doesn't sound too bad. At least there's a logarithm in there, and the m is the smaller element. But we can do better than that, and this chapter is dedicated to show you how. So this is in red because it's non-optimal. A first observation is that you can do the following as a complete alternative. You can flatten the trees to lists. So you have two trees that you want to take the union of. You make them into lists. You merge them, like in the phase of merge sort. And then you get one long list and you build a balanced tree from that. And then the overall complexity is m plus n. How does that compare to m times log n? Well, this is actually better, the m plus n. If you know that m and n are roughly of the same size, then you can easily see that m plus n is better than m times log n. But this is just a special case, and we want to be to always win and not just in special cases. And the rest of the chapter is dedicated to a quite acute divide and conquer approach, and it has the additional advantage that it is really highly parallel. That's something we haven't considered so far, and I will only hint at it, but on a parallel architecture this can really give you a boost. The cost that we will get is theta of n times log again, but then not just n, but n divided by m. If you have a reasonably not too small m, then this really gives you a considerable boost over the m times log n. And the point is that this idea works not just for red black trees, but it works for many kinds of balanced trees. And so much of the presentation will be quite generic. And for ease of presentation, we will use a concrete type of trees, but keep in mind that there could be other different kinds of trees that don't quite fit exactly our presentation here, but they still fit under the umbrella of this divide and conquer approach. Okay, so how do we implement this divide and conquer approach? We, for simplicity only, postulate that we use a uniform tree type, the tree type that we've always used. And why is that? Because red-black trees or AVL trees or also weight-balanced trees and many others can be implemented as these binary trees where the contents of every node is actually a pair of a key and some additional information B. And the B is typically the balance information, like in a red-black tree, the B would be the color. And if we work with these kinds of trees, we have fixed the data representation, but really it covers quite a few very different balancing schemes. And in this chapter, whenever I write tree, it really just means an abbreviation for A times B tree, which is quite long, and that's why we just abbreviate it to tree. Now, the cute idea is that all these bulk operations like union and intersection, etc., but also the single insert and delete can be programmed in terms of just one operation, namely the join operation. So we assume we have a join operation that takes, as usual, a left subtree, an element in the middle, and a right subtree. And the idea is that the join operation is roughly the same as if you built this node as given with some appropriate balance information, which is just represented by an underscore here, and then you rebalance. So this join operation builds a node and balances, because the L and the R might be of wildly different sizes. And thus, by using one join or another join, you're getting either red-black trees or weight-balanced trees or other trees. So the join operation is where the balancing schema is hidden. Okay, so now we assume we have this join operation that takes two trees and an element and gives you a new tree. And given that, we will show how to implement insert and delete and also union, intersection, and difference using a number of auxiliary functions that I will introduce one by one. One very important auxiliary function is the split function. What does it do? It takes two arguments. It takes a tree and it takes an element. And it's supposed to split the tree into two halves, namely all the that part of the original tree that is smaller than the element you're giving it and that part that is larger than the element you're giving it. And the element itself is removed if it was in the tree, and the Boolean that you're returning is an indication on whether the element was in the tree or was not in the tree. And if you split an empty tree, well, that's very easy. You split it into two empty halves, and of course the element was not in the tree. More interesting, if you want to split a tree that is a proper node, and you now have to compare the element X, which is the split, the pivot, with the element A, the root element of the tree. How do we do this? Well, of course, we compare X and A, And clearly, if x is less than a, then we need to perform the split in L, and otherwise we need to perform the split in R. So let's first look at this less than alternative. X is less than a, so the split must lie within L. So what do we do? We split the L part. We split L into two halves, L1 and L2, at point x. And B is the indication of whether the x actually was in the tree L. And what do we do then? Well, then we reassemble things. L1 is still the left part of the split, but the right part of the split is not just L2, but also R. So we need to combine those two. We need to join them. So this is what we return. We return as 1/2 L1. B is the indication that we got out of the recursive call of split. And then we join L2 and R and put the A back into its right place between L and R. If they are equal, well, then it's very easy. We want to remove the A, and we are already given the split into the two subtrees L and R, and so we return L and R in the indication true that X really was in the tree. And then there's the greater than, which is symmetric to the less than. Using the split function, we can now implement the insert function. How does that work? Okay, we want to insert X into the tree. So what do we do? Obviously, we want to split the tree because we've just claimed that split would help us. So let's do that. We split the tree T along the x-axis and get 2/2 L and R. We don't care whether X is already in there or not, because now it's no longer in there after the split, because the split has removed it. And then we rebuild the tree and we just put X into the root with the join function. Delete is quite similar to insert, but here we don't need a split function, we need a split min function. So what does the split min function do? It takes a tree and splits off the minimal element, the leftmost element in the tree. How does that work? It has to be a proper node. You can't split an empty tree and get something out of it. So if it's a node like that, then how do we split off the minimal element? Well, it depends. If L is empty, then we have the minimum element in our A, and we can return the A and the right tree. Otherwise, if L is non-empty, then the minimum element must lie in AL, and we must recurse. So we split the minimal element off L. We get the pair here, M and L prime, and then we reassemble things by returning M as the minimum element and combining L prime and R. And we combine them as before with a join function. We need another function to realize delete, the join to function, which doesn't join a tree and an element and another tree, but just two trees. This is how join to can be realized. Obviously, if the right tree is empty, then we can just take the left tree. Otherwise, if the right tree is non-empty, then we can split the minimal element from the right tree and get the minimal element M plus the remainder right tree, R prime. And what do we do now? Now we can call join because we now have an element M. And that's exactly what we do. We join with the original join function, the left subtree, the minimal element M, and what's left of the right subtree. And now that we've got split min and join, we can program delete. So how does delete work? It takes an element and removes it from a tree and gives you a new tree. And this is the trick. We first split As in the add function, we split the tree into a left and a right part along the x-axis that has implicitly the split function removes also the x, so there's no x left in it, and then we just combine L and R again. And we use the join to function rather than the join function to combine these trees with a missing element in the middle. Now, that's all very well. Now I've shown you how to program the single element operations, but we're really interested in the bulk operations. Now we're getting onto those. Let's look at union first. Takes two trees and gives you back a tree. Union of T1 and T2. First, the trivial cases. If T1 is empty, then we return T2. If T2 is empty, we return T1. And if they're both non-empty, then our divide and conquer strategy kicks in. What do we do? We first look at T1. It's a proper node with two subtrees, L1 and R1. So we have already one split of the set T1. And now we want another split of the set T2, but not an arbitrary one, but one that is guided by the A. That is, we use the A here in the T1 to split T2. So we split T2 along the A axis into two halves, that L2, where L2 contains everything below A and R2 contains everything above A. And now this is where that was the divide part, and now comes the conquer part. Because you can now, in parallel, take the union of L1 and L2, the two sets with the smaller elements, and R1 and R2, the two sets with the bigger elements. And then you just, at the very end, you join them again, the L prime and the R prime, and you put the A back into the middle. And that's it. So this is really why it's highly parallel, because you have these recursive calls of the union function. As we will see later, these two subtrees will be of roughly comparable size, so you're also getting some kind of balanced recursion here. Intersection is a bit more interesting than union. So you get given two trees, and you want to take the intersection of the two sets that are represented by those trees. Again, let's start with the simple cases. If one of the two trees is empty, then you return the empty tree, because the intersection of the empty set with something is always empty. Now we know that both trees are non-empty. So now we look at T1 and get an element A in the middle, and again, as before, use that to split the tree to T2. But now we don't discard the information on whether A was in T2 or not. We remember that in the variable A in. So we've again performed this split of the two trees that we want to take the intersection of. And now, it may not be completely obvious, but it's not that hard. You can again do this by looking only at the smaller sets and the larger sets. So here we intersect first L1 and L2. Well, it does make sense because all the elements below A are in these two sets, L1 and L2, so it's sufficient to intersect them. And similarly for the elements above A, they are in R1 and R2. So we get these two new trees, L prime and R prime, that contain the intersection of the small elements and the intersection of the big elements, small and big with respect to A. And what do we do now? Now, we need to look at the information. Was A was definitely in the tree T1, but was A also in the tree T2? If it was also in the tree T2, then we need to put it back into the intersection. So if it was in tree T2, then we need to use the ordinary join function, joining the two intersections and putting A back in. If A was not in the other set, in the set T2, well, then it can't be in the intersection either. We drop it, and instead of the join function, we use the join to function. Final bulk operation, set difference. Again, first a simple case. So difference means we subtract from T1 the elements in T2. So if T1 is empty, then clearly the whole result is empty. If T2 is empty, then we get all of T1 back. So we're again in the situation, both of them are non-empty. We again analyze T2. Well, actually not again. In the past we'd analyzed T1, but why not take T2? And then we split T1 along the A axis, the A coming from T2. So we've got again a separation into small and large elements along the same split value A, the same pivot A. And then we can again perform the difference separately on the small and on the large sets, and then we can put them together again with join 2. Let's first check out why is it okay to ignore the A, well, or ignore the information whether the A was in T1. So here we're just dropping this Boolean flag, we're not remembering it. Why? Because A is in T2. T2 is the set that we're subtracting. So that means the A can't be in the final set that we have, that we obtain. Now, I already started to stutter a little bit, saying, oh, it's not the same as before. T1 and T2 are exchanged. Why is that? Why do we exchange the role of T1 and T2 like this? Think about it for a moment. The answer is it could be done the other way around, but this one is simpler. Because if we do the same thing that we have here, but with T1 and T2 exchanged, then the element A comes from T1. And then the question of whether A is in the difference depends on the split in of T2. As it is, we can ignore this, and we can always drop A. So the code becomes a bit more simpler if we write it this way around. It doesn't have any impact on the efficiency. That's the implementation, but of course you wouldn't be in this course if we didn't treat the correctness aspect as well. So I will give you a top-level view, no proof details of how correctness of this implementation is established. So first we need some specification for this join function. And that's pretty easy. It's supposed to join trees, and it's supposed to give you the union of the elements in the two trees plus the element A in the middle. And it's also supposed to give you back a binary search tree if you start from a binary search tree. That is, if you join two subtrees L and R and an element A in the middle, and the whole thing is a binary search tree. So if you start from this assumption, which essentially just says L are smaller elements than A and R are the bigger elements than A, well, then this should imply that you get a binary search tree out of the join function. Remember, the join function is a parameter of the development that you saw. We know that it operates on these augmented trees, but we need to say what kind of properties it has. And so it should certainly have the union property above, and it should also create binary search trees. But there's also an unknown structural invariant, because it depends on whether we're talking about red-black trees or AVL trees or what. We call that inf, and we need to require that inf holds for the empty tree, and that if it holds for a node, then it must hold for the two subtrees L and R. So this is an unusual composition. It just tells you that if the invariant holds for a big node, it also holds for the subtrees. And we have the other direction. If the invariant holds for subtrees L and R, then the join function must preserve the invariant. So this is really the last property, is a property requirement on the join function, that the join function really behaves nicely with all the invariants, both the binary search tree invariant up here and the structural invariant down here, that could be the colors of a red-black tree or something. And everything you see here are local assumption contexts for the definition of union, etc. So all the definitions of these functions that you saw were in the context of assumptions, of those assumptions about the join function and, of course, its interaction with the invariant. So that was the specification for the implementation level. There's also a specification for the abstract level, namely the ADT or locale set 2. That's an extension of the set locale. If you remember, set was the locale that contained all the axioms specifying insert and delete and isIn, and now we're extending that with specifications of functions union, intersection, and difference that take a set and another set and produce a third set. And what do these specifications look like? Well, they say the obvious, that if the invariant holds for set S1 and the invariant holds for set S2, then if you take the union of the two and take the set of elements in the union, it should just be the union of elements in the two subsets, S1 and S2. Now you have to be careful here what's going on. We have two levels. Let me just go back one slide. This is the level of the abstract implementation, where we use a join function that could be anything, but we have to assume certain properties of the join function. This is really the specification at the set level that makes use of the set operations, like here the union operation. Whereas here previously on the previous slide, we're also making use of the union operation, but we're using the set tree operation, so we already assume that we're working on an implementation level. And there are there's the other requirement that the invariant must be preserved by the union operation. And the same for int and diff. So it's just a straightforward extension of the set specification that we saw before. I'll show you here. Nope. Here. This is the locale, as it's called in Isabel speak. So it's the abstract data type called set2, which is an extension of the set data type and adds these operations and assumes the properties that we saw on the previous slide, that given you have two sets that satisfy the invariant, then the set of the union must be the union of the sets. Let's go back to the slides. So that's the abstract specification at the set level. And we will focus on union for the correctness considerations. And we just looked at this theory. And now what can we prove about union abstractly when we just, I mean, the implementation of union for the union code written in terms of the join function, what can we prove about that? We can prove that if we start out with a binary search tree, then the union operation as coded really has this property that the result represents the union of the elements in the two trees that you are unioning. So this is really a theorem about the code that we saw earlier, this piece of code here. This piece of code satisfies that specification under this assumption, namely the assumption that the join function has all these nice properties. And similarly, we can show that the union function preserves the binary search tree predicate and preserves the invariant, the structural invariant. So we have enough assumptions about the join function and the invariant function to be able to prove that. The binary search tree predicate, of course, is something that's fixed for search trees. We don't need any assumptions on it. We have the definition. And the proofs are automatic, but only for union. For intersection and difference, you have to be a bit more careful when you do the proof. It's not that much more difficult, but it's not automatic. And now we can realize this as we can using these correctness lemmas, we can implement the locale set 2, that was the abstract set specification with unions and intersections, and we can just instantiate things one by one. This always looks a bit funny, union equals union, but of course you have to understand that the union on the left is the union on the set theory level, the union on the right is the implementing union, is the union on these balanced trees using the join technique. And the invariant is the combination of the binary search tree invariant and the structural invariant, whatever that may be, because that is still an overall a parameter of the system. We can just show that under the assumptions about inf, we have a valid implementation of the set 2 interface. And you can look at the details in the file that you see here on this slide. Everything so far was abstract in the sense that we did not commit to any particular balanced search tree. Now we will. Now we will look at the only function we do need to look at, the join function. How is that implemented for red-black trees? And we will just take a cursory look at it. So this is the general idea, not just for red-black trees, but in general, how do we implement this join function on some kind of balanced trees? We assume, just for the sake of this presentation, that L is the smaller and R the bigger tree. And we're trying to build a join. And of course, it has to be balanced again at the end. And so what we do is we descend along the left spine of the larger tree until we find a subtree T that's about the same size as L. I'm putting these things in quotation marks because it's not necessarily exactly the size and smaller, but it might be some other kind of measure like height. So without reading the text, this I think exemplifies what's going on here. You have the left subtree that's smaller than the right subtree. You want to build a join. So you first descend along this spine here until about here, where you find a subtree that's small enough so that you can easily join it. Easily join it mean you really build a node of L, A, and T. So you put the A here in the middle, and then you go back up in the recursion and you rebalance the tree on your way back up. That's the general idea. How is that realized for red-black trees? This is the join function for red-black trees. So now we don't assume anything about the sizes. Remember, here we assume that the L is smaller and R is larger. Here we don't do that. This works, or is supposed to work, for arbitrary trees L and R. And now we explicitly make a distinction. If the black height of R is less than the black height of L, so the size here in the red-black trees is the black height, is used as the size, then we call a function join R. So that's what we saw. No, that's not what we saw on the previous slide, because here we're in the case that L is larger and R is smaller, and that's what the join R means. You're supposed to join the smaller element R, smaller tree, onto the larger tree L. But in the other case, if the black height of L is less than the black height of R, then we're in the previous slide, and we call join L, which means, so you, this is the tree, L is the one that we're joining onto R, and we're gliding down on R. We will see that in a moment. And if they have the same black height, well, then you're lucky, you can just produce a new black node. So we just need to figure out how does join R and join L work. We need to store the black height in each node, because we keep asking about the black height of trees, and if we really need to compute that every time, it would be expensive. So we will finish this lecture with a brief look at the implementation of the join function on red-black trees. So here, this is just again the join function that we saw, which is a kind of dispatcher. It figures out which is the larger and which is the smaller tree, and then dispatches to either join R or join L. And let's just look at join L, because that's the one that we also saw in the diagram. Here we are. Join L assumes that L is the smaller and R is the larger tree, at least initially, and then you go down R on the left spine, so R becomes smaller, and then we test here, have we descended far enough, so has the black height of L already become larger than the black height of R? Well, then we're okay, we can just combine them, and otherwise we need to descend along the left spine. That's what you see here. Here is a recursive call of join L along the left spine of R. And otherwise, here is another recursive call of the same nature, but some of them must be balanced. So this is the balance function from the red-black trees, and others can be, we don't need to do any balancing. So this is just the realization of this picture here. Where we descend along the spine of one subtree and find a spine of one tree and find a subtree that's small enough so that we can combine it easily with L. And that also brings us to the end of the lecture, and I would just like to mention the literature. So it took quite some time before this idea became more popular and also became analyzed. So the basic idea goes back to Stephen Adams, who actually won a programming competition with this idea. And it was published in the Journal of Functional Programming, but there was no analysis or correctness proof or anything. Then some, more than 20 years later, Guy Blalock and students of his, they actually analyzed the complexity and showed that it has the complexity that I showed you on one of the earlier slides, m times log of n divided by m, and also showed that it has the nice parallelizable properties. And this is really a great article because it also lifts the idea from a specific kind of trees. Stephen Adams used weight balance trees and said, hey, it has nothing to do with weight balance trees. This works for a large class of balanced search trees. Okay, and that's it from me for today.